does God?
Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast. I'm your host, John Williamson, and we're back with a brand new episode that I am super excited to share. Before we get to that, I just want to say a quick thank you to everyone who reached out about the ongoing issues with our website. I apologize. It's been a number of things that we've had to resolve. So we think we finally have it straightened out to where they're all fixed. But again, the new site is the same one as before, only .org instead of .com. So it's thedeconstructionist.org. Otherwise, it's completely the same with access to our blog. You can stream every single episode there for free. You can hit up our online store with new international shipping and even join our Patreon. So thank you guys for being patient. It should be up to date, hopefully, as of this recording. Okay, on to important stuff. Recently, after having had COVID for the third time, unfortunately, and having to move and get my kiddo started a new school and all sorts of other life events that obviously threw a bit of a wrench into my intended release schedule, you know, lots of things came up, but we're back with a new episode this week, and hopefully we'll be back on track the rest of the year. And so I've been using this downtime to record lots of new interviews that I'm very excited about, lots of interesting topics that I think you guys will enjoy. So should expect content, new content every week now through December. So with this one, really, really excited to share this one with you guys. I had the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Timothy Morton. Can't tell you how much I really enjoyed this one. For those of you who have been listening for a while or have gone back to our prior episodes with our friend Peter Rollins, I think you'll really connect with this one. In fact, it reminded me so much of our conversations with Pete that I had to connect the two afterwards. And I'm praying the two at some point can do something together because I think that would be pretty special. So cross your fingers for that. But I think you guys will really enjoy this one. A little bit about Tim. He's the Rita Shea Guffey Chair at English at Rice University. He's collaborated with Bjork, Laurie Anderson, Jennifer Walsh, Adam McKay, Jeff Bridges, Olafur Eliasson, and Pharrell Williams, to name a few. He's written books and essays on philosophy, ecology, literature, music, art, architecture, design, and food. He was an absolute joy to have on the show, and we had a great time talking all about his brand new book, Hell in Search of a Christian Ecology. So without further ado, Tim freaking Morton. Is God even here? Does she care that I doubt? Does she care that I fear? All right. Welcome to the podcast. Very excited to have my guest on today. It is Tim Morton. Thank you so much, Tim, for coming on the show this afternoon.
Gosh, it's an honor and a pleasure to be on the show, John. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. So you have a new book, and it's obviously got a very grabby title, Hell, In Search of a Christian Ecology. And you cover a lot of things in here, but before we get into that, because we will, I like to ask my guests five sort of random questions so that folks can get to know them beyond just the academic side of things. So I'm going to start out with one I think you'll have fun with, but when you're relaxing and you want to put some music on, what's sort of your go-to band or artist?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, you've caught me here at an interesting moment. Yeah. And actually, you know, there's so much of me in the book that I will inevitably end up saying things that you've already read about in the book. I grew up in the world of music. My father was a violin player. He was the go-to violin player for all the psychedelic and prog bands of the late 60s and early 70s. He played for the Beatles. He played for Procol Harum. He played for Crazy World of Arthur Brown. He played Mike Oldfield. He played the violin solo on Lark's Tongues in Aspic, uncredited. I mean, he just did so many things. And my mum was a concert violinist. Both my brothers are or were musicians in professional bands. And I'm the one who didn't do that. In a way, to a little bit survive the power for me of music. You know, music for me is very powerful. And I'd like to think that when I write, I'm able to evoke that music. And I know when I give a lecture, we arrive in a kind of mind-meldy space after a while that's not unlike listening to music. It's just, I like it. Funnily enough, right now, maybe because I'm going through so many transitions, you know, but I'm actually only capable of relaxing to two things. And these are extraordinary things to relax to. I mean, I listen to Indian music. I listen to medieval music, Beethoven. I listen to Stockhausen, everything. Yeah. Techno, you know, there's so much in the book about coming from 1988, you know. Right now, this is so odd. You asked this question. There's an English composer called Vaughan Williams, Ralph Vaughan Williams, and he's got a ballet called Job, and it's based on the Book of Job, but more importantly, Blake's illustrations to the Book of Job. Now, this is not very relaxing, right? This is about Satan torturing this guy, and he kills his family. But for some reason, you know, maybe the hair of the dog that bit you, we're probably going to get into this, right? But I'm a complex PTSD person, right? And so maybe it's that. But funnily enough, I'm finding this Job very soothing. And then the other one, which is another one about the devil, I can't believe I'm finding this one relaxing, which is Roger Waters' version of The Soldier's Tale by Stravinsky, right? A soldier sells his soul. Well, actually, he swaps his soul in the form of a violin for a book that tells the future, and all kinds of things happen from that. And on that subject, just yesterday afternoon, I sat down with my son Simon, and we watched the film Bedazzled, the first one with Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, that I hadn't really seen outside the context of my dad, who will sort of loom large in this conversation. It was a wonderful cathartic moment. It's yet again another thing about the devil. There's so many funny things, and it's funny when I say devil and you smile, because this is actually, this is kind of part of it for me. When you say Satan or devil, the natural impulse is to sort of grin, you know. And I find this kind of weirdly cool in a funny way, but then some funny accident will occur to me, and then I'll think, oh, okay, maybe. So that's what I listen to quote-unquote, brackets, exclamation mark, relax.
I like that. See, I knew I was going to get a good answer, and we'll definitely touch on the theme of, like, the arts that you draw from in the book. But have to ask, and this is because it's on my mind right now, I'm finally going on vacation next week. Favorite place that you've been visited or gone on vacation?
Wow. You know what's funny? I'm a very protean person, and I can also make myself comfy in a lot of different places. And I was just talking to Simon, who's downstairs. He's 15 years old. He's just gone on holiday, about going to Mount Kailash in Tibet, to circumambulate Mount Kailash. Now, the funny thing is that I've made this huge turn to Christianity, but don't be scared, people who are listening to this, who are trying to make a huge turn away from it, because funnily enough, I accidentally wrote a book for you, okay? But, like, I didn't know you existed. I beg your pardon. I walk around in a Winnie the Pooh-ish haze of total ignorance, right? You know what? It's for me, it would be the ancient indigenous sites of Britain that still exist. Avebury, it would be mine. It's like this ancient village surrounded by like a 5,000+ year old stone circle that sort of interweaves itself into the village. And there is something about that place that is profoundly, beautifully soothing. But actually, just last week, I was in Britain visiting my long lost stepdad, who I consider to be my real dad. And we went to Norwich to do a book launch. And I went to see Julian of Norwich's little cell that she was in. And for some, now I've been to meditation caves in Tibet, and I've been in there, you know, with women meditators from 900 years ago were in them. And there are nuns in there right now doing it, you know. And there's the same kind of, please believe me, the same kind of feeling in there, like a vibe of incredibly soothing. Yeah, because this is somebody who's been around the mulberry bush of all of their stuff, you know, for years, and sort of come out the other side and then gone back in and round. It's just sort of like to feel really joined, because that's kind of like what I do, much worse than that.
I love that. That's a great answer. So obviously, I'm assuming also a fellow bibliophile. And I feel like I already know the answer to this, but favorite author, your go-to author?
Well, you know, I am definitely going to say William Blake. I finally got to write a book. Is it about Blake? It's very pretentious to say with Blake, but it's definitely not about Blake. You know, I was going to do my dissertation on Blake. I really wanted to. I'm an English PhD. But my problem was it was just going to be a bunch of quotations with little pointers going, hey, check this next one out. It's really cool. And that's not a dissertation. Yeah. So, but finally, I found a way to do the Blake book that I've wanted to do. And finally, I let myself, I'm very weird, I don't let myself do things sometimes. I let myself connect to the Blake superfans in the Blake Society. And that was absolutely marvelous and wonderful. So William Blake.
Love it. Okay. So how about something that it would surprise people to know about you?
Gosh. Now, so you've known this is now my head's gone blank. And actually, probably this is something surprising to know about me, which I've just said, which is that, okay, so I'm this full professor guy at Rice University. I'm the Rita Shea Guffey Chair in English. I have a very nice salary. I'm a very privileged, a very lucky person. I published 25 books, translated 47 times into 20 languages. I'm friends with Björk. I'm friends with Laurie Anderson. But this morning, I failed to get an email about a meeting I was supposed to be having later in the day because I'm on the panel for the National Book Award, and I didn't get this email about a Zoom meeting. I thought we were going to have a Zoom meeting. And I went into a PTSD episode. Yeah, and I just want to tell people, I'm giving this interview. If anybody's had any trauma experience with toxic group stuff, which is the same, I hope. I mean, I don't want to speak for anybody, but I had a psychopath narcissist dad, yeah, from a criminal underworld culture, which we might get into. And I'm here to tell you that whatever experience you had in the church that was like was really like that, because I've been listening to this wonderful show quite a lot. And I just want to validate people's feelings here. You know, like it's not unreal that you feel like you've been poisoned and you feel like it's all your fault and you don't know which way is up and like all this stuff. And it's like, there's part of me thinks I shouldn't have a job. I shouldn't have a house. I shouldn't have a car. I should just be homeless on the street. Like my little brother Steve is like isolated in this little house. You know, he's got really bad schizophrenia. My little brother Charlie's in kind of recovery, not recovery, mega addiction stuff with his mum. I should be that. How come? So I also have a huge dose of survivor's guilt. It's like I survived, right? Like I kind of survived. So like I get this PTSD episode, like, I can't function. I'm actually talking to you right now. I am talking to you now from inside of a PTSD episode. I'm very privileged as well because I had 3 years of EMDR therapy with state, ego state stuff about the incredible dissociation that I have. And then underneath that, I had 24 years of psychoanalysis, yeah. And I'm telling you, is there anybody who's listening to this feeling distressed or weird? I paid six-figure sums to this one guy, I must have really liked him, to get enough therapy to figure out what had happened to me in my childhood and then to start to recover from it with the help of this EMDR after 27 years. So if you're not able to figure it out right now and it feels horrible, just give yourself a huge break, okay? Because, like, that was real, what happened. And part of you saying that can't be real. I must be wrong. This isn't right. I understand that from my point of view because I escaped by accident from an incredibly toxic. And you wouldn't believe the parallels between a very coercive religious environment and a criminal underworld environment. Or perhaps you would, right? But like, I'm not talking about actual crimes which happen, right? I'm talking about the dynamic because, you know, funnily enough, criminal people have a very strict moral code. The nice guys are the soft, ambiguous guys, right? These guys are rigid, like rigid right and wrong. You screwed up, you whistling the wrong tune and you get yelled at. That's happened to me. Yeah, like even your choices of clothing, right? Yeah, right? And so I deeply get, I think, you know, again, I really don't want to talk for anybody here, but I deeply resonate with what people are going through on this show in my own way.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's a great place to transition to sort of my opening question, which is, you know, I'm always curious as to people's experiences growing up with religion. And obviously we talk, you know, predominantly about Christianity on this podcast. So talk a little bit about that. I feel like that's a good transition from what you were just talking about.
That's a good transition, John, you know, because like, it seems to me that whatever religion is, it's always with us. Right? Religion, spirituality, whatever you want to call it. You could call it how we relate to the nasty, yucky, abject-making boundary issues of being a life form. Right, the book's got a lot of that stuff. So to that extent, trees have religion and ducks have religion and single-celled organisms have whatever that is, religion, right? Because they've all got this inside-outside dilemma. How much of the outside am I going to let in? Have I just been poisoned by accidentally swallowing this thing? Right, like that's the symbiosis dilemma, right? And all kinds of things like that. Oh, look, just look at me, I'm this mess. It's random genetic mutation, you know. So whatever religion is, it's about that, right? And so I could say, on the one hand, yeah, so I got peer pressured into my first ever gateway drug called Christianity when I was like 13 years old. But I soon got out of it because I was like, every time I'm in church, I feel like the devil. I'm having all these doubts and thoughts, and I'm like, I'm the devil now. And I was all right. I didn't realize how messed up I already was. Why am I feeling like the devil? You see, the backstory, of course, being I was already in a religion much more strict and sinister than the kind of low churchy Church of England thing from St. Luke's Church around the corner from my house in Wimbledon Park, and certainly much more sinister than the sort of rather Anglo-Catholic fancy one at my school, of St. Paul's School. This was my dad's criminal underworld religion, where, like, for example, snitch is worse than murderer. I know it sounds unbelievable. Have you ever heard the phrase Cray twins? Like, the London Mafia was deeply connected to my dad, right? I didn't even think I could write about this or talk about it ever. So it's amazing to be able to talk about it on the show. You know, I wrote this memoir consisting only of inanimate, so-called inanimate objects a couple of years ago. And I thought, what a relief. I don't have to talk about the real stuff. But then, about the people, I mean. But then I had this surgery, and something about the surgery reset my insides. I was like, right, that does it. I'm going in there. And after the surgeries, March last year, I wrote 100,000-word vomit memoir in 10 days about all the bad stuff that had happened. And it started off with this little tiny radius vortex of revenge. I'm going to get my own book. And weirdly, it just through the writing process was very healing, and it kind of widened out into this big, big circle that I didn't even know what it was. And I was like, wait a minute, this is mercy. Because I'd already forgiven my dad, actually, the year before, 2022. I had this really strange dream, and I woke up with all this space inside of me. And it's like, I can hate my dad and love my dad and admire my dad and ignore my dad and be amazed by my dad all at the same time, because there's a big space. Oh, right. That must be what forgiveness is, because it's this big space, right? Like, it's enough. It's like a big meadow for everything to happen in. And sort of like mercy is how you feel in that space, right? And it took like a whole year for the mercy thing to show up. So like, I was already writing this book. You know, I was already writing this book when this happened, right? So that was the religion I was in, and that was I escaped from that, right? And I didn't even know what I was running from when I, you know, so like getting out of Christianity into Tibetan Buddhism and stuff through my 20s and 30s was like, in a way, superficial, I now see, compared to the actual religion, you know, that I kind of, I didn't even know I was escaping. I didn't even know I was surviving. I just accidentally moved to America, and suddenly I could think straight a little bit, tiny bit, you know. But it took me years to figure out how upset I was, because I was so wounded. And again, I thank you for the privilege, John, of being on this show from inside a PTSD episode here.
My privilege and honor, absolutely. That's fascinating, because, you know, I think for so many people out there who've had experiences like that, where they've suffered, you know, whether it's a church or a person, it takes sometimes, depending on how severe and how long you're in it, it takes years to unpack that. And I'm sure there's still some layers that you're still.
Oh, yeah. So a couple of things here. The trouble is, the really sick thing about it is, this is supposed to be about Jesus, yeah? And in the name of Jesus, there's this torture going on, and it's the same thing in a way. This is supposed to be your dad. This is your dad, right? Like, I'm a dad. I don't know what dad is deep down inside. I'm just making it up so that my kids never have to go through any of the stuff within 100 clicks of 1% of the stuff that I went through. Right. But I don't know what that is. You know, I kind of do, though, because I realized that with my PTSD stuff, I've been ignoring my lovely stepdad, Morris. Yeah. And he and my mum split up in 1997. And I just like loved him, but I didn't talk to him. Yeah. But I had the surgery, and very quickly after writing that thing, I realized I have to reconnect to Morris. So I got an agency, and the agency found him. And now we're texting every day. I just come back from visiting his house. I call him Dad. He is one. Please forgive me, Dad. He's boring. Yes. Hooray. He is reliable. Yeah. You know, he's loving. He's slightly irritating. All these things are great, right? Like normal, quote unquote, Oedipal dad versus Frank from Blue Velvet or Jack Nicholson. My dad was actually the spitting image of Jack Nicholson from The Shining.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Morning people wake up for peace and quiet. McDonald's breakfast people, we wake up for the sweet rush of getting that warm, delicious breakfast right before it ends.
Crush your morning goals with a steak, egg, and cheese bagel or any breakfast sandwich and snag another one for just a buck with the buy one, get one deal. Only in the McDonald's app. Limited time only at participating McDonald's. Valid once per day. Must opt into rewards.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
So you come sort of full circle here to writing this book. And as you mentioned at the top, it's deeply personal, but it's also just, which I love, by the way, infused with things that you pull from all sorts of different arts. There's images in here. There's paintings. There's poetry. You pull from a wide range of sources, but obviously the common thread, as you mentioned at the top, is Blake. Why Blake?
Well, thank you for liking that aspect. Like, just to harp on the awfulness that I was just talking about for one more deliciously horrible second. In a way, the lovely luxuriness of the book, and it is, it's like a Thames and Hudson shiny paper, heavy, dense, beautiful, illustrated, everything, and it's really not expensive for those, please buy it. Like, it's great. And in a way, that it's like this beautiful shiny suit of armor that protects you from the horribleness inside of it, right? That's one reason to use that, is just to kind of protect, just to kind of hold you as you're going through. Because, Leon, what I'm doing, I'm using all this stuff, this experience, to help people understand and deal with the biggest thing that's happening to us, which is global warming, right? Global warming, because it's so big and horrible, and it could be the end, blah, 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 extinction, whatever, and everyone's panicking about it, it makes you feel like you're 1, 2 years old, right? So, and I know what that is, and I know how to survive it, right? So I'm like, at least I can use these horrible things as like medicine to help people, maybe, right? And so that's one reason to use it. And one reason to use Blake in particular is that Blake, you know, first of all, Blake is our contemporary, right? Blake is our contemporary. We're living in the same time as Blake. We're living in the same time. We've still got the legacy of slavery and actual slavery. That's the main thing, right? We've still got the possibility of monarchy. Just look at the previous guy who might come back in to be the next guy. And if you Google images, Gilray, Trump, I mean, if you Google, pardon me, how funny, Freudian slip. Three cheers for Freudian slip. If you Google images, Gilray, George III, you will see Gilray's drawings of George III. He's the spitting image. He's got the same horrible embrasure. That lip thing that he does, that sort of embrasure, the sort of hooting, pouting, aggressive lip thing that the guy does. Yeah, he's got the same nasty, jowly face. He doesn't have a comb over, but he has a wig. It's the same difference, right? He's got the same. He got the nasty little squinty little. Am I really looking at a sort of suspicious looking eye? It's this incredible, ambiguous, like contradictory monster puppet from hell. Right. And we've still got this. We've still got the possibility of king. And why? Because all somebody had to do was ignore the unwritten Sam the American Eagle rules of presidential politeness and actually go there and talk about enjoying enslaving people in not code. Right. That all he had to do was ignore the rule. And then people are like, oh, he speaks his mind, because some people actually think they want the tyrant. Right. So we're living in Blake's time. Blake was dealing with this. Right. Blake was like a working class guy. He did illustrations for books. It's what he did to make his money. But it's an incredible imagination. It's like, how do I cope? How do I cope? I'm a Christian person, but Christianity is being abused by mobs of thugs who come and destroy my best friend, Joseph Priestley's lab, because they think he might be a nasty woke, me too, atheist scum because he discovered oxygen, right? It's that we're living in the same time. And like the paranoia and the sudden bursts of wonder, you know, and the sudden clarity, right? And the horrible sense of time just dragging and dragging and dragging because you're inside this dictator's head, you know. And I know all this from my abusive childhood, right? So the endless hours in my father's sort of outskirts of hell house, right? Just kind of like, when will this be over? That sort of feeling. And Blake wrote poetry from inside of that. So basically Blake was writing like yesterday or like 5 minutes ago. And he's giving you these incredible tools for how to deal with it, because rather than just describe it and go, oh, this is terrible, he's actually giving you psychic weaponry, which is the only weaponry that I would like to employ, right? As he says, bring me my bow of burning gold, bring me my arrows of desire. He literally doesn't mean we're going to shoot people. He means just brandishing that golden arrow is so compelling and so powerful, it's just going to melt everybody's soul who sees it. And that's where we're going to, it's like the kind of Martin Luther King, I have a dream magic. It's like with one sentence, I can disarm everybody and open up the future. And like how to be a really like responsible artist, or possibly you could say, he calls it mental fight. You call it psychic warfare. You call it ideological struggle. It doesn't matter what you call it. In fact, all this narcissism of small differences on, it doesn't even have to be the left, just not wanting tyranny in your world. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. The enemy is over there, right? And I know about, like, my brothers were set against me, and I couldn't, and I fought everybody else except for the main guy for a long time, yeah? And I know about that, right? But it's like, truly, the enemy is over there. I'm pointing at an invisible, sorry, I'm not pointing at you, John, I'm pointing at the previous president of the USA, and what that guy stands for, which is just the continuing legacy of slavery tyranny.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my gosh. I do have a question related to that, as we continue on, but I think early in the book, you know, just as an example of how Blake just seems to sort of understand and sort of, you know, predict almost, you know, it just goes to show that history is completely cyclical, but he talks about, and you reference this in the book, you reference the event of Columbine, which I remember distinctly. I remember thinking back then that this is an anomaly, certainly. Like, we'll never see anything like this again. You know, boy, was I wrong. But you mentioned the fact that Blake so perfectly defines what it means to lose your innocence, or for innocence to be lost. So dig into that a little, because I thought that was a fascinating point.
Please, let's go there. That's great. The sadistic cruelty with which Marjorie Taylor Greene said to Jasmine Crockett in Congress the other day, did I hurt your feelings, when she talked about the fake eyelashes, right? Mm-hmm. It's the same kind of cruelty that is perpetrated on tiny people. The incredible fact that people think that innocence means ignorance is because, and I'm just going to say this so other people don't have to, there's a lot of incestuous, sadistic violence around. You know, my mom was a big old social worker in the 90s. And like, she said, you know, if you can see, she would say to her employees, she put people in prison for this, yeah, eventually. And like, if you can see one instance of it, it means it's everywhere. One tiny, like, fragment of a hint of an instance of it, it's everywhere, right? One photo of Jeffrey Epstein with the guy, bang, it's everywhere, right? And like, this idea that innocence means ignorance is the ultimate paedophile fantasy, the myth of the innocent child, meaning not that the child didn't do any harm, but the sick thing is, innocent means he didn't do any harm, right? Like, are you innocent or guilty? We should know this, right? Guilty means you did the harm, innocent means you didn't do the harm. But somehow, innocent comes to mean we didn't do any harm to them yet, right? This idea of a life form who is your kid, who you could violate, right? And that would be fun, yeah? that is the innocence that when Columbine happened, I was working a few miles away in Boulder, Colorado, and I was very upset to find, and then I figured out much later, why are you upset about this, Tim? You know, CNN reporter sticking the mic into the poor high school people's face going, have you lost your innocence? Have you lost your innocence? It's like the guy with six fingers in The Princess Bride talking yes. to a guy. Tell me, this is for posterity, so tell me, how does it feel? Right. But you're asking a kid, right? You're asking a kid. Your best friend just got murdered in front of you. Tell me, how does it feel? And it's like, this is on the news. This is what counts as the news. This is because we live in this. I beg your pardon. I'm so sorry. Right. So there's structural racism and there's patriarchy, and it is not an illusion. And there is this incredible, like, right in your face, but like hiding in plain sight. That, which of course now people are thinking, oh my God, is he QAnon? Is this a QAnon thing that he's saying? But this is the trouble, that the QAnon is a pure projection, right? The idea that I am a paedophile lizard from space who drinks baby's blood says everything about the person who said it. And that's another really cool thing about Blake. Blake is all about the state of the soul or the psyche or the subject position or whatever you want to use. You can use Althusser, Lacan, Jesus, I don't care, but that, right, of the person who's saying the thing, right? It's like, let's figure that out, right? Let's figure that out. And so when Blake writes Songs of Innocence, what Blake's writing, in a way, are some of the only genuine nursery rhymes ever, because they're not written about cute little kids who haven't been harmed yet, right? They're written for and by kids who haven't done any harm and are therefore in an incredible position of emperor has no clothes power, like Greta Thunberg, right? She's so powerful because she can say the truth because she hasn't done any harm, right? And the amount of violence on her, right? Like, think about that. Like, think about the amount of attention. Think about how everybody lined up to have their photo taken with Greta Thunberg. And I was so disturbed by it because of what, I didn't even know what had happened to me by then. But like, I was like, wow, this is almost like, this is pornographic. Everyone wants to be photographed. Everybody, all the great and the good are queuing up to be photographed with this person. I went on Twitter. I said, I promise I will never be photographed with Greta Thunberg ever.
Yeah. It's what's so interesting about what you just said too, is I find so many parallels with sort of discussions we had over the years on this podcast, just about in reference to the subset, we'll say, of Christianity who are so obsessed with this idea of this punitive God and throwing people into this literal fiery pit for eternity. And what I've learned is what that says about that person who believes that, who's yelling those things at me. You know, it says more about them than it does about my reality.
Oh, but it's such hard work, you see, because you're told this, and then that locks onto your own legitimate feelings of guilt and shame, right? There's only one person in the world who has no guilt or shame. That's called a psychopath. They have no anxiety. They have no guilt. That's the trouble. They've got an advantage there because they don't have any guilt, right? But when they say something, you know, this is like I was saying to my little boy when he was like 3-4 years old. If a police car comes and a guy leans out and says, you've been very bad, you have to get in the car, go to the station, do not get in that car because that person is a fake police officer who's going to hurt you, right? And this is what's going on, right? In the name of religion, as it were, people leaning out of metaphorical cars going, you've been very bad and you have to get in our car, otherwise you won't blah, 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 right? And I understand the feeling of paralysis in that world. I was on this long retreat, but, you know, it may be of some comfort to know, in a funny, ironic Job's comforter way, there's that guy again, that this happens in other religions too. And I was in this Buddhist sort of meditation retreat in the Rockies with 400 people. It was a massive group. Everyone was falling in love with the guru, except for me and a friend of mine. Two people versus 398. You couldn't keep your mind together in that environment. You couldn't keep yourself together. You were brutalized by it. I came back but so like crazy from that. And I only spent a few weeks in it, right? So anyone who's spent like years in this, and one of the people is their parent, and one of the people, they live down the street, right? Just give yourself a massive break, right? Like get yourself a huge tub of whatever kind of ice cream, frozen thing you want. Just eat all of it. Don't worry about it. Really, seriously, being just stupidly nice to yourself for a very, very, very long time. You don't have to figure anything out. I can't figure anything out. I got this terrible PTSD. I got this medicine. I have medicine that I have to take sometimes. It gets really bad because my brain got changed by this, right? And so, what was the question again? This is such a great interview that I'm really like, this is so great that I just totally lost track there, John.
No, you were doing a great job of commenting on the point that I was making about the parallels between what you had just said and the ways in which people who are shouting at you that you're a sinner, you're going to burn to hell. Yeah.
There's a whole big thing to say about that, right? Which is that furthermore, these are the people who are actually creating hell in the here and now, right? There are these two, I call them frack boys with a CK, right? I don't know their names offhand, but they're Texan. I live in the state of Texas for my sins. And they basically, this is literal thing they say, right? Like, God never said not to drill in the Arctic. So you can drill in the Arctic. And in fact, God wants you to drill in the Arctic. Right. There's another guy who calls himself a born again Christian who says there's a huge well of oil 30,000 feet below the Dead Sea and I'm going to extract it. Right. In the name of creating their idea of heaven, they're creating hell. And my phrase for this is demonic angel. Right. Demonic angel. Like people who know they're the goody. That's what evil is in a way. You know, all those people who attacked the Capitol building on the 6th of January, they knew that they were the goody. That's how being a fascist feels. So please agree with me that being a good parent feels like being a bit of a shitty parent, yeah. Right? Being a good teacher means feeling like a bit of a rubbish teacher, excuse my French. And hopefully being a great country, a truly great country, means suspecting that you might be a bit of a rubbish country because of the legacy of slavery. That's truly great, right? Like being original sin is actually a nice idea. Like, I'm so sorry about this, but to just complicate things further, I had this, and I'm just going to say the most embarrassing way of saying it, because born again Christian thing. I haven't stepped inside a church because I don't believe in church. And my wife doesn't want to set foot in a church. She comes from pastors, but she's got this Simone Weil thing, right? But so as I say this, I'm like, wow, this is so ironic because I'm not rejecting something here, but I'm really angry about something, right? Demonic angel, the knowing that you're the goody, right? Whereas knowing that you structurally screwed up, it's like structural racism, original sin, it's like structural sin. It's not your fault. You didn't do it. It's just the way you are. That should be like the nicest thing you say about yourself in a way. That should be like the nicest, strokingest, loveliest thing. And I'm not being weird or cruel. I'm like, knowing that you're a bit broken should be the nicest thing that you think about yourself in the nicest tone of voice or the nicest way as you take a huge spoon of my favorite coffee flavored ice cream. It's a huge dollop of it. It's like, I'm a sinner.
When did we lose our way? When did the size of our buildings become the foundation? Until we're all treated the same. Church, what have we done? But there is hope, somewhere to go, someone to feed, someone to lead, someone to clothe. And who are we if not redeemed? Bringers of peace and justice, sweet and holy love. Oh, church, what have we done? Oh, church, what have we done? May we sell our souls to be rid of all the power and control. Church, let that be us.
A lot of products say they're clean, but what does that mean? Ritual has high standards for what clean means, like their essential prenatal multivitamin, which is heavy metal tested, clean label project certified, and GMO-free. It features key mom-to-baby nutrients like folate, choline, and omega-3. Clean isn't clean enough, especially during pregnancy. Get 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance, like your first home expansion or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Families agents. Life's better when you're under American Families roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.